सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।
वेलकम टू सोच विचार। टुडे वी आर गोइंग टू डू दिस शो इन इंग्लिश। द रीजन बीइंग दैट वी हैव डन अबाउट 30 शोज इन उर्दू एंड आई थिंक इट्स अबाउट टाइम दैट वी डिड सम इन इंग्लिश टू, बिकॉज आफ्टर ऑल हायर एजुकेशन इन पाकिस्तान इज इन इंग्लिश एंड मोस्ट पीपल शुड बी स्पीकिंग इंग्लिश. And with English, I think we can reach a wider audience, especially the donor community, which also has a big say in policy making in Pakistan. So with that, let's turn to another subject that we have pursued quite a bit in our earlier Urdu podcast, but needs to be pursued a lot more, which is education. I'm going to talk today to Ms. Nadia. Miss Nadia Navivala. Nadia Navivala, she is a young Pakistani who has done extremely well in the recent past. She is now a public policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center, a very important, well-known center in Pakistan, in the US, in Washington, D.C. She's also worked and is still working with the Citizens Foundation of Pakistan, which is, as everyone knows, a very important foundation for promoting education in Pakistan, one of the path-breaking foundations in Pakistan. She's also worked with the USAID, so she knows the donor community well. She's got she's got degrees from very good institutions, Georgetown and Harvard. But more importantly, the reason I'm talking to her is because she has written this excellent report called Pakistan's Education Crisis, The Real Story. That report I found very, very interesting, very well thought out, very well argued. She's written such reports before too, and she's written for Dawn extensively. But let's try and focus on education today, because as everybody knows, this is the most important subject in Pakistan. Pakistan is possibly facing a big education crisis. There we can agree, Nadia. So welcome, Nadia.
Thank you, Nadim, for having me on the show.
Can you please quickly try and summarize what you're saying in this report for our audience in Pakistan? Remember, our audience is hopefully economic students and economic policy thinkers in Pakistan. So tell us what you want to say to them about education in Pakistan. Then we'll take it from there.
Sure. Well, I went into the research for this report, which I did in Pakistan, not expecting to find much that would be different from the popular narrative. And I was actually really surprised. The picture that we have right now of the education crisis in Pakistan is that Pakistan does not spend much on education. Most people have heard a figure of about 2% of something, either GDP or budget, and that the way to solve the crisis is to double the budget. And finally, you know, our current picture is that international donors are filling the gap in financing what Pakistan does not spend. So what I found with this report, one of the first things I was really surprised...
Let me stop you right there for a minute.
Sure, yeah.
I mean, yes, we've all heard, I've been hearing it since I was a child, Nadia, that 2% is what Pakistan is spending on education. 2% of GDP is what Pakistan is spending on education. And the biggest problem in Pakistan is the spending deficit, that we need to spend 6% of GDP. In fact, if you think about it, all the major people in Pakistan have been yelling themselves hoarse that we want to increase our education budget. Are you telling me that that's not the real story?
No, I mean, well, so what is true is that Pakistan now spends 2.7% is what was budgeted this year. So the 2% of GDP figure is true. Mm-hmm. But what that translates into is 28% of the provincial budgets in Pakistan today. The difference is that Pakistan just doesn't have money to spend because we don't raise taxes. Mm-hmm. So while our GDP is growing and our education spending is 2.7% of GDP, that's translating into 20-28% of our budgets. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, our military spending is 2.9% of GDP.
No, I think you're going too fast. Hang on. You're saying how does it translate to 28%? That I don't get.
So we only raise 9% of our GDP in taxes, which, you know, is far below international standards. It's one of the lowest in the world.
So you're saying it's 28% of expenditure then?
28% of the budget.
Of the budget.
Budget.
28% of the budget then. Okay. It's 2% of GDP, 2.7% of GDP in terms of GDP. And then you're saying it's translating into 28% of the budgets, provincial budgets, right?
28% in KP and 18% is the lowest, which I think is Balochistan.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
Now I understand. Sure, go ahead.
But the UNESCO recommendation, so the international minimum is 4% of GDP, we know that. But in terms of percent of budgets, the international recommendation by UNESCO is 15 to 20% of budgets. So Pakistan is way above that. And if we were to increase to 4% of GDP, we'd be spending about one-third of our provincial budgets on education, which starts becoming fiscally questionable, because most of your budget is going into salaries, and you can't fire teachers easily. So if you put all this money into spending and then suddenly your GDP shrinks, you can't roll back your budgets. And so you're stuck with kind of this fiscal burden. It's a bit technical, but I think we need to be using other measures besides the GDP measure. The GDP measure, I don't think, makes sense to the common man who's has his kids in a government school. It doesn't make sense to even a lot of people who are interested in education or looking at the crisis. So, and that limits our ability to discuss what's actually going on and to see clearly what's even happening with the budget. So if we talk about percentage of budget, the way that the budget's being used, I think those are much more useful measures. Pakistan's constraint is that we just don't have the money to spend because we're not raising it in taxes.
But you're bringing me to another subject which I'd love to talk about, but that's, I mean, what has that got to do with taxes?
With taxes?
Yeah.
It just means our total budgets are a lot smaller than they should be. We're not raising the revenues.
So if we raise more revenues, you think it'll go to education?
It can go to education. It should. I mean, our spending should, in an ideal world, be higher if we had more to spend.
Okay. So the one issue is that we should be spending more on education. You still think we should be spending more on education, right?
If we can raise more, then we should spend more. But I think first we need to fix the way the budget's spent. We need to spend better before we spend more, definitely.
Okay, I like that. How do you spend better?
Well, first, I mean, the good news is that Punjab and KP have started doing it. Okay. The first, because about 85% of your budgets are going into teacher salaries, but your absentee on any given day, 1 in 5 teachers doesn't show up to school. So you have high absenteeism. So the first thing you need to do is compel teachers to at least show up to school.
Nadia, forgive me. I mean, again, I was a kid when you started talking about teacher absenteeism.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was at least 30 or 40 years ago, right?
Okay.
And we are still talking about it?
Are you absenteeism or ghost teachers?
Ghost teachers, absenteeism, both. I mean, I remember Shahbaz Sharif when he came in 93, 94, something like that, or maybe 96, something like that. He sent the army into schools to audit them and tell us about ghost and absenteeism, both things, right? And now we are still talking about it. That problem has not been solved.
No, actually, I think the good news is that that problem has been solved. Okay. It was the low-hanging fruit of the crisis. I mean, absenteeism is now down to 6% in Punjab and about 13, 14% in KP. So actually, now we're on to tougher questions. We've gotten the teacher in the school. We've gotten kids to some extent, or at least there because the teacher's there. And you probably have buildings that are not dangerous to kids, at least, but your enrollment rates haven't gone up. Parents are not putting their kids in school. And this is because kids aren't learning in school. So actually, absenteeism has been addressed. And even the ghost teacher problem has been addressed. But we still have a crisis, and it's because kids are not learning in school. And so parents don't see any utility to putting their kids in school.
Okay. So let's go back. It's a very simple problem then. I said this to a education conference full of my good friends, the education ladies in Pakistan, a long time ago. when I was in the planning commission, I told them that let's forget about schooling, because A, we can't make kids learn, and B, we have no jobs for kids. And why should people put their kids in school if there are no jobs at the other end? How would you confront that issue?
I mean, you need literacy. I don't think that's negotiable, right?
I'm not so sure, because see, the point is, let me take you back to this. I did my PhD with Gary Becker. And the theory then, and I think now, is also that human capital is accumulated for the sake of an investment. People make an investment in themselves, in their children, for a return in the future. Now, if we do not have a return in the future, which means a job that aligns to the kind of skills or the education that the kid has achieved, there is no incentive for the kid to gain that education. After all, that kid has to make an investment, right?
Yeah, I didn't look at the education crisis in a functional way or what we need to create jobs. Mm-hmm. I think it's a question of human value. Mm-hmm. And I don't think literacy is negotiable. And I think a lot of families, when it comes to a question of education, it's not just for jobs. They want their children to be able, you know, education is seen as a passport to some type of functionality and equality in Pakistani society. It's the only way to cut through a lot of the class barriers that we have. So I think there's a high demand for, if I had to guess, I would say there is a really high demand for education in Pakistan, regardless of what the, you know, financial payoff might be at the end. And I'm not, and I don't mean college degrees, but I mean just basic literacy, you know, a solid primary education, mm-hmm. you know, numeracy. I think if we could at least get there, we would have a much better society, regardless of the jobs that are available at the end. And those will be created. You know, entrepreneurship becomes much more doable when you can count and add and subtract and do more complicated functions. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, let's go back to something else. You said that kids are not learning anything. Mm-hmm. Now, what do you mean by that?
It's quite remarkable. I mean, schools that I went to, and this was in a kind of off-road village in KP, kids could not spell Pakistan mm-hmm. in any language, even in Urdu. Couldn't identify the first letter. And I showed them a map of Pakistan from their books, and they had no clue what it was. You know, they asked if it was a mountain. And so, you know, there's really nothing happening in our schools. About 30% of third graders can write a sentence in Urdu. And this figure hasn't changed since 2003. This is according to LEAPS data in Punjab. And even according to OSCR data, less than half of third graders can read a sentence in Urdu, national average. So, yeah, there's just, and this is the ultimate question, which I think we need to look harder at, which is, once you have the teacher there, how do you get the teacher to teach, or how do you get kids to learn? And in many cases, the barrier is multi-grade teaching, where you have, you know, from a 3-year-old to a 12-year-old in the same class with one teacher. So there are a lot of functional problems mm-hmm. as well in this. But
the one thing that's always bothered me is I keep seeing this data on, you know, that they can't read, and, you know, a little bit data on enrollment issues and a little bit of data on expenditures and ghost schools and et cetera. But I mean, I've also seen that the data kind of remains the same over the last 50 years. It's the same kind of data that's coming out again and again. Are these guys missing something, or is the data telling us something?
I'm not sure which all data sets you're referring to, but the LEAPS data since 2003 on learning outcomes, and this is not public data, but they've collected, you know, there's actually not much solid, reliable data that you can compare across years. OSCR data is not reliable. It jumps around dramatically year to year, especially for KP. But in any case, the LEAPS data, it does not change dramatically. Learning levels are not changing dramatically year to year. So, and they shouldn't. You should have some gradual improvement. But yeah.
So basically, let's summarize. You're saying that budget is not an issue, right? That sure, you can spend the sun and the moon on this thing, but Pakistan government is spending a fair amount on education, but the outcomes are just not there. And the data is sparse, but people believe a certain story. So let's go with the belief. Then I still don't get it. What is the problem then? I mean, please identify the problem for us. What is the problem? If you look at this education, let's say you go in there and you quoted a lot of McKinsey's and donor research. I mean, apparently DFID, USAID and McKinsey, a lot of people are doing stuff in there. Michael Barber is coming along with deliverology. What have we discovered? What is the problem in the education sector?
Well, we're at an early stage. I mean, I would say the good news is that schools minimally meet the standards for looking like schools. It's a huge, I mean, there's more teachers in Pakistan than there are in the Pakistani military, than there are people. So this is a huge, it's 55%, about half of provincial bureaucracies and governments are composed of education employees. So this is a really huge sector to transform. So at least we've gotten the management fixed to an extent where teachers are showing up in two of the four provinces. But we're still at an early stage, and we don't know how to fix it. We don't know how to get teachers to teach and how to get students to learn. So I don't know what the silver bullet for that question is. I don't think anybody does. And in the United States, you know, we're struggling with the same problem. But it is one that deserves a lot more research, and a lot more can be done on it.
But as your report also points out, what I call austerity budgeting, that our budgets are still consumed by salaries. So most of the school budget is consumed by salaries. The non-salary budget still remains very low.
Yeah.
And that means that the teachers show up for work, but as we say in economics, that it takes two to tango. You have to have both capital and labor to make production. If you have entities or schools underfunded, right, then you cannot possibly have the outcome that you want. And in this case, because there's no working capital, probably schools cannot perform as well. Is that an issue?
Working capital in terms of the non-salary budget to maintain schools.
That's right.
That's a problem, but they are reforming that. They have, you know, devolved the way that the budget is used. So now basically every school has a certain small budget that they can use directly on their school improvements. So they are finding ways to do the most in provinces that want to reform. They are finding ways to use the money better and make it, you know, go as far as they can. And ultimately, they can't fix every single school right now or provide a school for every single place that needs one. And that's where your budget constraint comes in. Mm-hmm. But if they can at least use the money they have better, it will go a lot farther. And they can save a lot of money. If Sindh solved its absenteeism problem, I think they would save as much as they're getting from USAID every year, at least.
But at the same time, we have this issue of for example, the Punjab government has given out laptops to students, has spent a lot of money on the Danish schools. So it's not as if they're not spending money. They're spending money on these issues too. This is also education when you distribute laptops and when you put in these large schools, Danish schools. Did that have a positive impact? Was that a well thought out policy?
Well, I haven't looked into the Danish schools, but in terms of the laptops, there are a lot of these types of schemes that look really good because they create tangibles for people. I guess it helps some people, but it doesn't address the primary school problem and it doesn't fix the education system. So it's not to say it's not good, but it's addressing a different problem.
So tell me, how much of the primary school of the education problem is also derived from the fact that we have no local government? Because received wisdom is that local government should be responsible for education, and local government will be more responsive because it is closer to the people that are seeking the education.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I thought in KP they actually have moved more towards local governance, but I'm not exactly sure on the answer to that.
So, but let me come to this. The other thing that you also mentioned in your report, which is that the role of the donors. We'll have a separate thing on that too. But just for this case, you mentioned that the DFID and USAID are deeply involved. You even have a picture of the USAID manual for teachers. So, what is their involvement, and how does it work out?
Yeah, so that was really interesting for me to look at. I know USAID quite well. I did not know DFID or World Bank as well. But what I found is that when you start looking at the provincial governments and what they're doing about education, very quickly you find DFID and the World Bank in different provinces. So essentially what's happening is that it's DFID and the World Bank that are backing the reforms in the provinces. And the way they do this is that each province has a plan for reforms and they have very specific targets. For reducing absenteeism or the number of kids to get in school or the state of the infrastructure. And as they achieve these targets, DFID and the World Bank straight dump money into the provincial budget. On the other hand, so they're providing the kind of spare budget to finance the reforms. So while the amount is small, it's about 2% is DFID's contribution, even though it's their largest program in the world. It's only 2% of what Pakistan spends on education. The value of it is that it's this kind of more flexible budget that the government has to use to pay for the monitors or pay for the monitoring unit. So they've provided this. On the other hand, they have these kind of technical advisors and experts, which is where McKinsey comes in, that have more capacity than the ministries, and that can be a bad or a good thing. So they've kind of worked out this model. USAID is very different. USAID is basically they kind of are doing their own thing. They're building 120 schools in Sindh. Sindh has 46,000 schools. These will be nice schools, but it's not transformative. And they're doing training for teachers nationwide on reading. But the reason I have the photo of that manual in the report of a teacher holding the USAID manual is because while she's been trained in reading by USAID and also by Beacon House for both Urdu and English, it's her third graders who can't identify the first letter in Pakistan.
Brilliant.
Yeah, so I don't know what good that training was to her, or generally, training is kind of the black hole of development aid. We put a lot into it, but really don't know what comes out
So
at the end of it.
essentially, what comes out of your report and what you're saying just now, it seems that the education reform process is being designed by the donors. Is that right? I mean, their consultants and their human capital and their capacity is what is leading the education reform in Pakistan, right? Because the Pakistan government itself is not.
Yeah, I think largely, yes, donors have set the model and developed those agendas. But the Punjab government does own it. It is education reform, I think, is the highest priority. KP was more autonomous, but I think they picked up a lot of elements of Punjab's plan. So it varies in terms of who actually sat down and wrote the plan, but it is coming, from the same place. And I actually think it's positive, but then the question becomes how committed is the government to it? Sindh, I question their, genuine, authentic commitment to reform. But they have a new chief minister, so let's see.
No, but there are two things here. If the reform does not work out, as you are sort of noting, and researchers after you, many will point out, that the learning outcomes are not there. Should we blame the people who designed the reform, or should we say, no, it was not their fault? It's the fact that the government was not committed. Because it kind of lets the guys who've done all the thinking and designing of the reform off the hook. Because they can always say the government is not committed.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I think what stood out to me in this is that Rightfully so. There's, and the donors point this out too, their contribution is actually small. Sure, they've designed this plan, but ultimately it's up to the provincial governments. A, it's up to the provincial governments to solve this problem and to implement these things correctly. But secondly, it's very, like, it is. This is a tough problem.
But I think what you're arguing is you're trying to argue through the amount of resources committed. But if you look at the history of reform in the world, reform is really a question of conceptualization, not money. When education reform happened here or the factory reform happened here, it was not money, it was an idea. So I'm saying that if the donors are presenting the ideas and design of the reform, then obviously, I mean, you know, hey, for example, I might disagree with them, you might disagree with them, but it doesn't matter. It's their reform that's happening. It's not about money then. It's about who has control of the design of reform, and that's an important issue too, or is it not? Or is it just money?
No, it's a good point. So I think the reform plans are kind of the best that a donor, the role in terms of the role a donor could play. But in terms of the specific design of the plan, you're right, it's open to critique. And I think, you know, experts, education experts that I met in Punjab were quite frustrated that they were not included more in the process, that they did not have a seat at the table. And
Now, isn't that a big problem?
That is, yes.
If you do not have local people included in the in the design, local experts, local capacity, and the one side they're talking about building capacity, and when capacity is built, you exclude them, right? Then you have a reform that has been designed purely by McKinsey's or outsiders, right? And if that reform does not work, then those outsiders, McKinsey's, etc., have an out by saying, hey, guys, you didn't do well enough in implementing it. I'm not sure whether it works. I mean, if let's say if GM hired me to design a car, I designed a bad car, GM would take me to the cleaners. They wouldn't accept the fact that GM didn't implement my plans well, right?
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, there, in terms of the design, there could be a more inclusive process. But the problem in Punjab, most people point to, is that it's the decision-making is happening by Shehbaz Sharif and by Michael Barber at one point, but Michael Barber has also kind of stepped back. So it's even within, you know, McKinsey is primarily staffed by Pakistanis, and a lot of them are really smart. And a lot of people who are working on the reforms themselves are Pakistani, and they're really frustrated because even they don't get their word in. Yeah, but I agree with you. Like, there should be more external involvement and critique of the designs
now, let me ask
and
you
the
quickly.
Implementation.
I think what you said, that to me, that is a problem when you said decision is being taken by Shehbaz Sharif. As I said, the way I look at an education system, let's say take the US, for example, or UK or whatever, education systems are very decentralized and large systems. And their strengths are that decision-making is not centralized. Decision-making is decentralized. I think Shehbaz Sharif's centralized decision-making is in itself a problem, or is it not?
It is a problem. I mean, this is, people repeatedly highlighted this to me.
Yeah. So given that, I mean, when we say that Shehbaz Sharif is taking this, it's a kind of a negative, not a positive, that Shehbaz Sharif is at the center of decision-making. I think the key decision that needs to be taken is, and Shehbaz should take it very quickly, how decentralized a system can we make and how quickly can we make it?
Yeah, no, I kind of saw by comparing the provinces that it takes a trifecta. You need the commitment from the chief minister to straighten out, you know, what's going on with education, the way the resources are used. But you need the chief minister to give the backing to the education minister, the education secretary. Say you have, you know, you have my political support, but you guys manage this.
No, but
that,
you know, all these people, McKinsey's and all these clever people, very clever people. I have a lot of respect for them. They're so clever. Do they, you know, have they recommended a decentralized system?
I don't know if they can. I'm sure they would like to see it. But
I mean, on the one hand, they're sitting there controlling the agenda. They're excluding the Pakistanis, the experts, the capacity.
Oh.
At the same time, they feel that they can't make that recommendation. That's so central that I find it a little puzzling. What should we do?
I don't know. That's a good question. I didn't meet I talked to people on McKinsey, and I haven't met Shahbaz Sharif, but it sounds like he's a tough guy to question or challenge. But I don't know if the top of the World Bank or DFID has tried to go to Shahbaz Sharif and say, listen, you need to cool it. I actually think probably only Michael Barber could do that, but Michael Barber's whole philosophy of deliverology is to have a strong executive at the top.
But
this is a place where, I mean, this Michael Barber's put forward a theory for governance reform. It's been tested very heavily in Pakistan, and I think it's time to kind of feed back and modify it according to what we've learned.
Look, theories of reform we have before as well, but we'll not go into that. Let's leave that alone. Let me ask you another question. As far as I've understood, and this is the debate, education debate in Pakistan to me has been very frustrating in the past, and that's why I stay out of it. The debate seems to be totally on getting the teacher to school and getting the schools sort of kind of enrollment rates up and schools working. But working only means getting the teacher there and students there. And that's very frustrating for me because I don't see that as education at all. That's like a prison scenario. We have to get the inmates there and the superintendent there. That's all. Nobody talks about the management of the system. I think the management of the system is critical. Would you agree with that or not? Is the management of the system, doesn't, so long as you get the teacher there and the students there, that's fine. And as I see in the picture in your report, there are students sitting on the floor. And, very cute, but I don't think that's great education, is it?
No, it's not education at all. But this is why it doesn't make, as someone who studies public policy, I am impressed that the provinces are monitoring and the teachers are present. And I can appreciate this change. Mm-hmm. To parents, it doesn't make a difference. At the end of the day, nothing's happening in school, and there wasn't any education before, and there's no education now. You're right. Like that, it doesn't. It's a daycare.
Nadia, I did a small survey in Dubai many years ago, where I interviewed about 100 Pakistani taxi drivers out of sheer boredom, nothing else. I didn't have a design or whatever. And my questions to them, one of the big questions was education. And I found this sample very interesting because these are Pakistani taxi drivers who have shown the initiative to go from Pakistan to Dubai, smuggled themselves in, did all kinds of things, paid fees, etc., and got in there. They're driving a taxi. These people come from all kinds of areas, from Balochistan, Peshawar, wherever. Yeah, right? And they had some education. So when I asked them, honestly, all of them were very upset. Three or four of them were actually angry with me. They said, it's do-gooders like you that made me get 10 years or 12 years of education. I wish I hadn't got it because I've got nothing in return. How would you react to that?
That's valid because, sure, I mean, the state offers its citizens more than just a school. And there are systemic problems in society when it comes to jobs and the way people are treated and the opportunities that they have. Mm.
Yesterday, there is a Facebook page for Soch Bichar. I put this on that page that what will you gain from your education? What are you, achieving, etc., etc.? And guess what students wrote? Most of them wrote things like, nothing. I will gain nothing, right? I can't even get a job because, the jobs come with sifarish and I have nothing that I can do, right? What do you say to these guys? Should they get an education?
Well, and these are these kids who have probably are in college or finished college.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's very true. I mean, I taught at a university and I, kind of ache for my students because I wish I could do so much more for them. They're brilliant and they deserve a lot more. But at a minimum, I mean, we're also talking about slightly different things, because as once you establish the basics of literacy and numeracy, then what does your education provide and prepare you for? And that's where, you know, we can talk about something different. Like maybe there's a lot of discussion about alternative education, which is more skills-based or relevant to people's environments. So you can get into that. But in terms of what a primary education provides, I don't think there's any way to negate the need for that to be functional. And the reason these kids can participate in that Facebook debate or those taxi drivers are speaking to you in the bay is because those are people who survived the primary system. And for everyone that survives the primary system and makes it to grade 3 or grade 5 at least, that's only about half your kids in Pakistan.
But most studies, I did a study on this a long time ago too, maybe 90s. Shahrukh Khan did a study on this, and a few others that I've seen. Returns to primary education tend to be very small and even negative at the points, because of the fact that, you know, primary education is kind of worthless. So there's a big issue there as to what we do. But leave that aside for a minute. I think the key issue, as far as I'm concerned, let's quickly summarize a little bit. So you're absolutely right that the government is spending a fair amount, but government, in my view, is spending even more than it should, given the learning outcomes. In fact, I've argued in some writings that we should close down all our education institutions because they're achieving nothing. And let's stop, save our money, let's not spend anything on education. I think that could be a valid argument. But the second thing is that we really don't have a design for education reform. This design that comes from outside, the World Bank has given us about 3 or 4 education loans, and they've not worked. So much money has been given to us, not just now, but I mean many years ago too. And quite frankly, that's failed too. What we measure is really just, you know, a little bit of can you read Urdu or not, and can you do this, or can you, you know, are the teachers showing up or not. So we're not even really sure of what the education data is that we need. In terms of management, we don't have a management design in our mind at all, and nobody wants to research it, nobody wants to talk about it. So long as a teacher shows up. But the school is more than a teacher. It's not just a teacher. And it should be more than a teacher. So the whole system is a mess and nobody's really talking about it. Would you agree with it? Yet there are so many people who are working on education. I mean, in fact, there are more people working on education than anything else as far as I can see. So what kind of research are they doing?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And that's where the discussion needs to be. It needs to be about what's actually going on. And that's my biggest issue with where the discussion has been, which is this 4% of GDP, which has dominated the discussion and kind of made any other type of discussion obsolete. Sure, let's say that we're spending too much and we're getting absolutely nothing out of it, and question the government when they want to dump all these resources into education and without accountability. Or what are the donors doing? What do the designs look like? Let's critique it. I think, you know, they finally will listen if the criticism is out there, whether that's, you know, Shabash Sharif or it's the donors or whoever it is. So, no, I mean, those are all... I took a crack at this, and I wanted to move the discussion somewhere else. So let's move it.
Yeah, good. See, Nadia, the other thing is also that the other problem also is... it's the same problem, as far as I can see, as in other areas too. And this is something that I just, in closing, let's address this. The key issue in Pakistan is that I think, quite frankly, we have become an intellectually bankrupt country. I see the same issue happening in, let's say, revenue that you mentioned. People believe raising revenues is a sine qua non. We have to raise revenues no matter what. It's like religion. And I strongly disagree. There's no reason to raise revenues. Because if you're going to use our revenues the way we are using them in education, let us not raise any more revenues. The key problem in Pakistan, as far as I'm concerned, is management. Whatever we do so badly, especially the government. There's no point in skinning the people for taxes and then spending them badly.
Yeah. Right?
So how would you react to that?
No, I agree with you. I mean, so if I lived in Sindh, I would find it very difficult to you know, to put more money into the government coffers if I know that they're just paying salaries for absent teachers. But I think in Punjab and KP, the governments are stretched for funds. And I think as they engage in reforms, they realize that they need more resources to finance them and that government donor resources are just not enough. So I think, sure, you cannot raise revenues in abstract, but I think as you reform, you need resources. And so it becomes hopefully a more of a virtuous cycle, but the reform has to come first.
Nadia, next time you go and do some work, please look at the structure of the education department too.
Okay.
Think about it. The education secretary runs the system in Punjab, right? As if it was his personal domain. Teachers are transferred left, right, and center without any say-so. There's a textbook board that produces textbooks that is extremely rich and has a monopoly on textbooks, right? Schools have no facilities other than a teacher, right? Whereas I remind you that Napoleon, when he lost the Battle of Waterloo, Wellington said that the Battle of Waterloo was won on the playing fields of Eton. It's not just enough to have a school with no facility, no playing fields, nothing other than just a teacher, right? And education is a well-rounded concept. It's not just about spending half an hour with a teacher. Right. The second thing that my favorite hobby horse is, there is no library in Lahore, my favorite, my city, Lahore, which is the city of Iqbal, which is the city of Fez, which is the city of learning. There are no public libraries. There are no public libraries anywhere in Pakistan. Right. I remember most of my education I got in USIS and British Council Library. I mean, you have to have a library to study because books are so expensive. I've checked with, you know, all kinds of poor people. I mean, you know, they can't afford books, for God's sakes. Where do they get books if they want to learn? And learning is not just about reading textbook board books. If you recall, most of us learned a lot by reading widely on the on various areas, whatever it is, right? So unless we address these issues, I think researchers themselves are leading the debate astray. Because they're so focused on measuring little things that are kind of meaningless, they miss the bigger picture. Would you agree with that?
Miss the bigger picture in terms of what the education system should be providing to people?
Not just the education system, what education is. For example, if if a kid in Pakistan just reads those textbook books and has no recourse to reading anything else, no Enid Blyton, no Harry Potter, no nothing, I don't think that kid can get an education.
Yeah. No, it's true. And this is the difference between literacy and schooling and education. I don't think we're there yet to be talking about providing real education to students, unless, you know, teachers are doing it because they're motivated and, you know, wonderful people. But yeah, systemically, I mean, we can't achieve literacy, let alone education is a higher bar.
But the point I'm making is that the fault may lie more with the thinker and the researcher and the planner than anybody else.
I don't know. I mean, I spoke to Haris Gusler and Faisal Bari, and they made identical arguments without having discussed it with each other. And they faulted elites in Pakistan for lacking a vision for what the education system should provide, because that ends up feeding into what happens in schools, because it relates to your conception of what a citizen is. So, you know, researchers and donors and the McKinseys, they can formulate your indicators and talk about meeting them. But in terms of the vision for the system, that has to come from the elites of Pakistan.
What does that mean?
Well, for them,
I mean,
you don't expect.
I mean, how would I define the elite for a start? And you don't expect the rich people to sit over their, you know, champagne glasses or whatever and talk about education policy, do you?
I do.
Where does that happen in the world? I don't think it happens anywhere in the world.
Well, it doesn't make for a very fun party, but I mean, elites, so it can be in, you know, Sweden achieved universal literacy because of the church. In Turkey, things worked because of Ataturk. So usually you mean somebody who is, you know, the elites who run the country or run the province in our case. So provincial party leaders, people, you know, I saw Jishnu Das recently, and the first question he asked me is, where's the vision? What's the vision? Mm-hmm. That's the first question for education. But I think at the same time, as elites or anyone who has any means, we should all be taking responsibility for the crisis. We should all be worried about the children around us in our extended households. Are they literate? Where are they going to school? What do they know? What can we do better for them? I think the fastest way to address this crisis is for everybody, every single person, to take responsibility for resolving it.
But that doesn't work, Nadia. How can every single person take responsibility? I mean, I don't know. What can I do to take responsibility? What can, for example, forget me, it doesn't matter. What can my, you know, an ordinary, let's say, a driver in Lahore or even somebody's, let's say, a rich guy who may be wanting to be a philanthropist, what can he do? A Citizens Foundation, what can they do? They can only set up their schools and run this. I think, quite frankly, a vision has to come from thinkers in society. And that's why I'm saying thinkers in society are copping out when they say that somebody else is to blame. No. Where is the vision that thinkers have put out? And thinkers have put out a vision that's donor-led and that's kind of, talking about these simplistic things, teacher attendance and things. We are forgetting the bigger picture, which is how the school management system, what the school management system should look like, how decentralized it should be. What are the inputs into education? Is it just a teacher? I think teacher is a very small part. There are many other inputs into education. For example, the library. For example, the playground. For example, the community. I mean, all those things are missing. And that's not missing because the elite missed them. That's missing because the visionaries did not even talk about it. They're so busy measuring the teacher attendance. They've forgotten about these things.
Yeah, I mean, so there, but there, a lot of stuff is put out by the thinkers. People don't read it, but the link that's broken is with the governments.
Okay,
I think.
Okay. So you're saying. Let's just quickly summarize. You're saying the fault is mainly the governments, and the thinkers are putting out the right stuff, and the donors are putting out the right stuff, but the government is incapable of doing it.
Yeah, I mean, we can critique what the thinkers are coming up with and what the donors mm-hmm. are putting into it, but ultimately the responsibility is with the governments.
Okay. Well, my view is slightly different because I think, quite frankly, the government is totally incapable of doing anything. It's been put into a situation where it can't do anything. I was in the government, for God's sakes. I was in the government for 3 years. I couldn't do a thing because the donors were dancing rings around me. You know, everybody was working. Absolutely. I mean, I had a bigger problem with the donors than with, you know, people inside. I mean, a lot of Pakistanis bought what I said. But there was a big lobby out there that didn't want to think differently. They were thinking in a very, very inertial sort of way. And they wanted to keep thinking in that inertia. They didn't want to change at all. And they didn't even want a dialogue on that inertia.
But if Punjab has dropped absenteeism to 6%, if they've fixed a lot of infrastructure, and if Sindh still has absenteeism probably in the neighborhood of at least 25%, if not 35%, the governments are to blame or can take credit for that.
I don't think so. I think the research has to be different. I think if you're measuring that small little outcome and doing that, that's... obviously, you can declare victory. But I think the fact that the kids are not learning, to me, teacher attendance is an input, not an outcome. Outcome mm-hmm. is the learning thing. Outcome is where kids are getting placed. Outcome is, how learned they are, etc. If that's not happening, teacher attendance is irrelevant. I'd much rather teacher didn't come to school. Some of the teachers, for example, I don't even want them to come to school because they're not capable of teaching, right? So, I mean, these are issues that need to be discussed. Anyway, I think, as always, we'll never agree. We have to, leave things there. So any last thoughts or any things that you'd like to complete?
No, I think that's good. We covered everything.
Good, great, wonderful, Nadia. Thank you very much. Keep up your good work. I understand you're going back to Pakistan. So, continue to send us some good, interesting, thought-provoking stuff.
Great. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Thank you. All the best.
Soch Bachar ke saath, mera naam Nadeem ul Haq hai.
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।